Hello, this is Nudging Pixels, where we take a deep dive into the who's who of Finnish tech and design, where we are all doing so much more than just nudging pixels. I'm Elina.
And I'm Maya. Full disclosure, I actually downloaded the Volt app only because the blue color they use, it's my favorite blue. It's actually been my favorite color since 2016. Anyway, for me, the food ordering part was just a plus. The blue looks so pretty in my obsessively ordered phone.
I can totally relate to that. I had a friend who once told me that if I ever started a company, we would never get anything done because we would get stuck at the logo design phase. You know, because I will just never be happy with any of the designs presented.
That is so mean. And also only like 50% accurate. I think as designers, we can bring so much more to the table.
Yeah, and it always makes me so excited to learn about companies that have designers in their founding teams.
Which is why, for this month's episode, we spoke to Elias Aalto, co-founder of Volt.
We talked to Elias about being one of the design guys in Volt's founding team, scaling a design team in a fast-growing startup, and the compromises you sometimes have to make on the way. Welcome, Elias, to Nudging Pixels. And maybe we can start just by asking, who are you?
I'm Elias Aalto. I'm one of the co-founders and product lead at Volt, which is a food delivery company based out of Finland and currently operational in 13 countries and 40 cities around Europe. I'm also a co-founder of Quick, which is a digital consultancy with roughly 80 people based in Helsinki, and an Apple Design Award winner for my iOS games. Well, one of the games, Wooden Labyrinth 3D. I also made Payazzo and got sued by the Finnish gambling monopoly. I started coding in university. I did two courses, the basics of C++ and basics of Java. And so I had a flimsy knowledge of development and a flimsy knowledge of design. So you can't really be awesome at anything, so you just do all of them in equal measure. And that's why I've ended up doing all of them, sure, but mostly then like trying to be in the middle of those and then perhaps the business side a little bit as well, yeah.
You've been doing this for a while now, so how do you see design has sort of changed from when you first started working and to now?
I really think, like for me, the change really happened, of course, with when iOS changed, because I'm an iOS guy. I've been only developing for iOS since the very beginning. And then when iOS 7, I think, really changed the style out of the skeuomorphic, let's put some leather and stitching everywhere into this very plain style. I think we did lose a little bit of something there. I'm not a perfect fan of today's sort of design aesthetic. You just have to look at like iOS, like go to the address book app and create a new contact and look at that form and where this sort of love for simplicity has taken us, where there's just text like floating in this white space and is very disorienting. And I just, like games were unaffected if you don't consider the indie hipster games. And I think there's very good design in those as well. But like a lot of the AAA games are still very these like strong and like very overdone in some sense and very graphical and rich. And those didn't get affected. It's funny how like only the sort of mainstream apps and the sort of the side of utility changed overnight and very rapidly into this flat and minimalistic side, and where some of the medium didn't change, for example, games. And I kind of, sometimes when I'm using gaming UIs, I'm like, oh, this is the side where you can still play with animations and graphics and light effects and whatnot. And it was actually one of those struggles in the early days of Volt, because I really wanted it to be more rich. And now, in the beginning, so I was the only developer doing the front end. So I did the iOS app for the first 2.5 years alone. And then one of our co-founders, Mika Matikainen, who's a designer, we were sort of the pair coming up with how the app would look. And he was doing the layouts and I was sort of breathing life into them in some sense, making sure the animations and the motions are correct and finding out those where we could mix those. But we had a lot of struggle in sort of pushing it to be more than just like very white and lines. And because Mika, as a designer, was more drawn towards that, whereas I wanted it to be colorful and not just white everywhere. And so I think the original one struck a nice balance. Now, over time, we've even moved perhaps more towards the sort of simplistic side of things. Now we are adding a dash of illustration into it in the upcoming. So I'm again more satisfied with it.
Yeah, I do agree too. I think because sometimes also the flatness and the minimalism sort of gets to too many places. You know, everything doesn't need to look that way. I understand if, I don't know, if like a very serious application has to be that way, but if somebody's also trying to portray the idea of being a bit more fun or more lighthearted, it would help to have some more. But yeah, actually about the Apple, the iOS thing, I was listening the other day to a podcast and I realized that the only application in iOS, like one iOS native apps that still looks like it used to look before is the Notes app. It still has its old texture with the whole embossed text thing going on. And I think that's sort of like stuck in time a bit, sort of like a sore thumb, I must say, amongst everything else. Yeah. But maybe it's something to hang on to.
Yeah, I guess there's no one dares to touch the code. There's like some reason where, that one guy once developed it and it's been there for 10 years now and we dare not touch it.
You mentioned your collaborative way of working with Mika, who's the designer.
Yeah.
So can you tell us more about that? How do you work together and balance between your opinions?
That thing, like that two-person team is very key in the beginning and making that work. I still feel more of a developer than a designer. I still think that in the end, it's the developer who writes that code. And the designer may hate it, but the final touch is actually done by the developer. And if the developer is not up to the task, and I've seen that where we've in previous companies and projects and whatnot, had like beautiful designs and ideas how they should be. If the developer isn't like turning the, he's creating the life into it in the end. So I think it's actually very key to have these very design driven front-end developers who do it, who make it so that out of the layouts, it's not just that they are matched perfectly, but they become better. Whereas, because a lot of the developers these days, they are more interested in the beauty of the code and are we using the latest frameworks or not? I'm notorious in the sense where I use the old, true and tested ways of doing things and I don't really care how it looks on the inside as much as I care how it looks on the outside. I think for the user, there's no compromise. There's no MVP that should be launched where the user is the one who sees the compromises in your product. I think you should always build the facade perfect. And behind it, you may have whatever like dodgy building behind the facade. It doesn't matter as long as the user never can look behind the curtain. And that's, and it really worked with Mika in the beginning because, I guess because Mika gave me also space where mostly I could sort of overrule things. And like, because you need, I don't know, I don't even care whose vision it is, but I think most of great things are built with a sort of singular vision and not a sort of mixture of or sort of compromise of many things. Like, there's a reason why Tesla is an exceptional car, because it's like Musk's, like, he's a crazy overhyped person, but still that car is very different than anything else out there. Out of the products that I built, I still think the sort of Volt version one is, based on the sort of how much actual resources we had to make that happen, I think it's one of the best I've built or have been part of building.
We've seen in the tech world how design has sort of, the role that design plays, how it has changed from maybe even like a decade ago. Like it's become like a really important part now. And but even so, you still see the odd company or the odd product where design sort of always, like hiring designers or having designers as part of the team is an afterthought. Yeah. But at Volt, there were two of you who were sort of like sort of designers and mm-hmm. part of the founding team. Yeah. How do you think that has helped shape the product? Obviously for the better, because it is a really good product, but how did that help from the beginning? And
I still see like these startup teams that don't have a designer, that are supposedly consumer products, that then have like some person who is just like a CFO or something. Like, what? No, there's no money before you've made a product that sticks. Like, you don't need a person counting the beans until you have beans to count. Like, how did it help? I think it was key to having that. Then again, I'm one of those, I said I was a consultant and I did a lot of startup applications, and I didn't really trust that any of those startups that I made the app for would ever succeed, because I don't believe in outsourcing your core. And we had a big founding team, so we had six people. So we had the sort of luxury of having a lot of the bases covered. So we had two backend developers, me as a frontend, and then a designer on the sort of product side of things. But when you want to be the very best, as you sort of in your naivety think you are when you found a startup, right? I think you can't compromise on those things then.
What has been the evolution of design at Volt from the beginning to now?
I think it has followed much the same thing that has happened actually on the tech side, where initially there were two cowboys, me and Mika, who do things their way. But then you can't scale that person, right? And then you have to have more people. Like, if you can compare the early sketch files and some of the Photoshop files that I did for Volt, which were horrendous in terms of, like, are they beautifully organized and are they labeled correctly and are they using components? No, they were not. They were bespoke one-offs. And then you go towards now, and what Timo has done, especially on the design side, design mobile side, is sort of build, flesh out our components and from a design point of view, and then build upon those. And now the file is much more organized.
How many designers do you have currently, or design teams even?
This is perhaps surprising, we don't have that many designers. So we just recently, we hired our brand director from Helsingin Sanomat. Then we have Timo, and then we have Natalia. Last I know, we only had four.
Okay.
People have constantly thought that Volt has more people working on it than it does. That it's more sort of customer or like user centric in its sort of design, and that it has more designers than it does. Because I was invited to speak in this like user centric design thing, and I had to decline because at that point, we had done zero like things with our users, really, in terms of designing it. I think this goes back to when you're a startup, you just time is a luxury you can't afford, really. And I think you have like a heightened requirement of not asking people too much, and you should know, or you should have an idea how it's done, so you're faster. It's tricky. That's how I see it, and people probably disagree a lot. When we built our first restaurant app, because we have to build an app for the restaurants as well, and they use it, I sort of thought, well, it was a collaboration. Of course, we had ideas thrown around, but I drew the first one. It essentially looks the same today. I mean, it visually looks prettier, because it wasn't pretty, but the sort of basics of the layout are, the UI is the same. And it's actually completely different than any of our competitors, which is interesting. It is. And I have never worked in a restaurant. None of our founding team, except for one who had worked one summer at a McDonald's, has ever worked in a restaurant. And we never asked any restaurant's opinion on it and how to build it. So we, and I'm not glorifying sort of ignorance, right? Yeah. But sometimes that wasn't actually our core product. Our core product was the user side. And we had bought a lot of stuff online and we wanted to build an app. And so we had a sort of gut feeling how that should be done. And we did what was necessary on the restaurant side. And turns out it was actually pretty good. And we were actually in the Kultainen Huippu Gala, and we won two of them. And someone tweeted a message like, oh, it's easy when you have all the resources. I'm like, yeah, we have one developer on the front end, we have two on the back end and one designer. Like, which corporation team doesn't have four people working on a product? Like, we had the lowest resources, most likely, of many of the competing things. But it's how much fakery in the beginning you put building those facades. Do not look behind them. Yes.
But I mean, it doesn't really matter, right? Like, what people think, how many people are working on something, if they think that more people are working on a product, I think that's only like a strange sort of compliment.
It's another question that is partly related to that, to the users and how you involve users in your product development. Or do you have any other, like, previous projects where you have involved users actively in the product development?
Oh, and these days, yeah, we do that. So it's also it's when you're small, it's a personal thing, right? So I'm not a person who likes to talk to people or, you know, invite them over and test my app, especially when they're wrong. And they're like, that's not how you use it. Okay. And like, neither used to be our designers. They were not very sort of expert people who would just, you know, do it unless they were forced. Yeah. And now these days we actually have product leads who relish in going out there and involving the stakeholders, and that's awesome. I think you shouldn't solely rely on that, for sure not. And you shouldn't solely build your products based on metrics and analytics. But also have some intuition and gut feeling laced in there. I think it's a balance of all of those. We were initially skewed towards just this gut feeling and then just prior experiences and trying to be smart about it. But nowadays we're more balanced, and I think it's like, we also try to hire people who naturally do these things, because I don't think you can really force it. Well, you can force it, but I don't think it's going to be pleasurable and valuable. So I think it really boils down to the individuals doing the work, really, that they are equipped with the way of dealing with the customers. Now, like, recently we again changed our address picking thing. And when I say address, I mean location, and it's completely different. And for that, we actually did go out on the street and ask a bunch of people to use it and see how they succeeded and whatnot.
But not like structurally doing it. You don't have a, like, feedback loop.
have a million hungry users. We get feedback, all right. And I think that's also one of the sort of, so you have to differentiate and between like loud noises and then the common undertones that, and that's tricky. And sometimes people fail with that and they attribute that because there's some person who's complaining about it. And then someone mentioned this, that there are paper cut problems. I mean, would you switch your paper supplier because the other one is giving you paper cuts? And I would say, well, no, so it doesn't matter. But these tiny annoyances and then that lead then to, because in our case, like all the mistakes, they lead to such horrible, horrible situations. Like you misplace your address and then there's not only your food gets screwed, but also because he's already carrying the next one and that's very expensive. Not to mention annoying for the users, right? And like, finding out those things that cause even a little bit of discrepancies in the process. Because when it works as an old machine, it's just, it's magic. But it's finding out those small things that really end up happening and causing a lot of issues. That's tricky. And those scale with time. Because initially we had, when we launched home delivery, we made it so that it didn't default to it. And so you had to choose it. And you could only choose it on the checkout page. It was this tiny button to choose it. But because we didn't think that home delivery was our number one thing. Yes, it was. And people thought that we were just a home delivery provider. And so we had an error rate of like 3% of our orders were ordered as takeaway, but they thought we would deliver it. And then it says, your food is ready now, go pick it up. And at that point, they contact the customer support and like, yeah, how's it coming to me? Like, and we would kind of be like, we never even entered an address. That could have been a giveaway then. Probably not. And it's sometimes hard to find those. Mm. And sometimes you have to just be, well, our info page for restaurants is shit. Well, yeah, and we're not going to touch that. Because nobody goes there and it looks like the first version of Vault, essentially. It's not good. Yeah.
It's all about prioritization.
The difficulty with design is that is your product evolves and you never have time to do it all. Like you are, like, at least for us, and we've never been in a situation where we're like, oh, okay, let's stop new feature development for half a year and let's just redo the whole app with this new design. No, well, what ends up happening is we fix some of the bigger things that aren't super annoying, and then we build the new stuff with the new design. And then we realize, oh, there's that thing that is completely different color and wrong font, by the way. Oh, we do that at some side project, whatever, but you will always end up with these different layers of app, even within the same app, let alone like the whole presence of a big company. And I don't think it sort of can fix that part.
Yeah. It's also, I think I was also taught design in this mentality of make it such that nobody else knows that you've done anything. You know, yeah, like the user shouldn't know that you've done anything at all. And that was the good design that I was taught, so that they don't see any mistakes, they don't see any differences, and like, you know, they don't feel like it's designed. It's just all natural.
Of course, I come from a world where I want all of our first UIs were very bespoke, and they were just, everything was done from scratch. There was no components. Like, screw them. When you want to make the perfect thing, you don't have components, because a component is already a compromise in some sense. You know, because you build it for something else, you're not using it for this. I mean, of course, if you like could build it for this use case only, it would be slightly different. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, we are worse at ordering pizza in some cases than a pizza app, because they are only ordering pizza, but we can order so much more other things. So we don't have a UI for choosing to have your pizza filling on the top left quadrant, because that makes no sense for anything else. We make it more general purpose. But if you're Hess Burger, you're going to make your burger ordering app a little bit better for ordering burgers, but it's not going to do much more. And so I think the threat of design systems and componentizing everything is that you never then handcraft the perfect solution for anything. It's just, I like making things custom. And I think there's always compromise in using components. And we use a lot of components with our tools, and because they don't need to look, they need to look functional and smart, but not anything crazy. And the people, the teams who have built our tools, they're just leaps and bounds ahead in terms of reusage of components compared to like our customer apps, which essentially have very, very little, where everything is kind of, every new UI is built anew. Though then the design is systematic, but even still we do a lot of that stuff custom.
And when you think about the team and the product and the culture that you have, yeah, of the team, how has that changed, or how have you sort of tried to keep that in check when you've expanded even your offices to other cities across Europe?
We have our team in like every country we go to, not every city, every country. So the local team in Israel is what, 5-6 people? I don't know the exact number, but it's not that there is like this vault HQ which is 200 people. No, it's there's 10 there, 15 there, 10 there. So I think the expansion is actually easy in that sense, where each of the country operations is actually a very closely knit group of people, and they get to experience that like small company busting your ass throughout. Like, I think the product team is more difficult to sort of maintain that, the nice aspects of the startup culture.
What about in the terms of the product then? Because I heard somewhere that going global was the goal of Vault to begin with. So how has that shaped the design of the product?
So the thing is, we have now, 13 languages, 14 languages in the app. And we have some weirdo ones. And we started out easy. Like, yeah, we only did it in English. The first version is English exclusively. Then we added Finnish and Swedish. And it's fine. Finnish is kind of crap, but because it's so long sometimes, and it's hard because you can't build sentences out of it. And well, you shouldn't anyway, but you can't do a lot of the nice stuff with Finnish. But at least we know it. And we could do it ourselves, and it was quick. We have a working knowledge of Swedish, enough so that we understand what it says on layouts. And sometimes you could write a couple of lines into it, and it was fine. And then we had Estonian, I think. And you no longer have any idea what it says there. And then you add Russian, and you don't even know what the freaking symbols are. So if there's a bug with them, like, good luck. And then you add Georgian. Do you know what Georgian alphabet looks like?
No idea. No,
it's like from a Lord of the Rings, man. It's like these elven scripts. And you introduce a lot of issues with that. And nothing is ever, again, pixel perfect. Though we do make our pixel perfect layouts for the sort of iPhone 6, 7, 8 size. And then the plus size is not, and the X size is not. But we make our designs on that. But then we switch over to iPhone X size, and now we're actually making all our layouts in iPhone X size. So I hope you have that phone, because everything else is sort of a compromise. But you make similar compromises with language, right?
Yeah.
But then you go to Middle East. So we have Hebrew. And right to left is, you can't understand unless you work with that, how messed up it is. If you see the first time you start thinking about it, how it lays out and all the bugs, and it's not just the text, because when you press and you go forward, they go to left, and the back arrow goes right, and you swipe them. But time moves right, numbers are from left to right, like it's just, and of course you have Latin alphabet within that text, and then it goes left to right. It's just, and some side effects that come from that when the frameworks work wrong, and you have no idea how it should look like, because you can't even recognize the letters.
So Vault was obviously built for a lot of users and different kind of users. So was accessibility ever a concern?
Though our app is mostly lists, and they would work quite nicely with the pre-built accessibility features of the operating systems, if they did, if we didn't break it ourselves, because we build it so custom, they just don't work off the shelf, and so we have to build some support for them, and we haven't so far, and I think we should. We are, again, so mainstream now that I think we should start supporting that. And my sort of politically incorrect thing is, I think you shouldn't in the beginning, because you have to get traction before you have to be able to conquer the world. And if you start with all the exceptions, you're moving too slow. And I think now starts to be the right moment. Mm-hmm. And I think we should, yeah. But I also beg for forgiveness why we didn't initially use there's just so many things, and then you can't do it all.
I think in an interview you once mentioned that the name Vault keeps it open for the platform to be able to deliver more than food later on. So yeah. Is that what you see the future of Vault as? Like delivery of various different types of things?
We have a lot of options, right? So we actually just started something like that, right? So you know you can order your pet food home from Mustafa Miri. Yeah, so we have, I think, 10 locations. That's something that our operations can do on their own, because technology is the same. It's like, it's just a restaurant that is actually not a restaurant. We have three components in our business. We have the customer, then we have the restaurant, and then we have sort of the logistics, the courier. And I think we can delve much deeper into any of these three. And I think this Mustafa Miri case and delivering something else is delving deep into the courier side. So we have that courier fleet. What else can we deliver with that? One example is, I think the shortest delivery time, like a year ago when we checked from verkkokauppa.com to get your gadget of choice, was the next day. And the express super delivery was like 20 euro. 20 euro? Like, and you can get your food delivered for 4 euro in roughly 30 minutes. This is next day, and they don't even give you an exact time. So we're like, wait a minute, I think we could do something about that. So I think there are opportunities, a lot of them in the delivery side. But there are also opportunities elsewhere. So if we talk about the restaurant, then now we have that iPad app that is essentially just managing the order flow. And while we do have some marketplace features where restaurants can sort of drive demand, I think there's a lot to do there, where Vault is going to be their number one marketing platform as well, and to give discounts and different campaigns and whatnot, and get perhaps if a restaurant wants to open a new sushi place, they could perhaps buy from Vault an info of where should I open a sushi restaurant, because we of course know where sushi restaurants are, where there would be probably demand. And so you're there. right around there. And that's actually something that like Uber Eats, for example, does. Mm-hmm. They consult restaurants on where they should open new locations, and they even sometimes they contact a restaurant and say, well, we need a burger restaurant here. Are you going to do it? Or are we going to take someone else to do it for us? And then not even considering like point of sale systems and like helping with table reservations, because I think it's could be linked where like these things all happen on the restaurant side, and I think there's a breadth of those things there.
Is this also how the design delivered thing Wolt did during Helsinki Design Week? Is that how that also sort of fits into the idea of Wolt being something more than food delivery, or was that just a one-off thing that happened?
Design delivered was a campaign where we sold artwork by local artists. It was more in the artistic grounds that were chosen, not for sort of purely how to sell a lot. I think it was more of a hobby project from our design people, because I think the issue with that is, again, it reaches people who already know of Wolt, because they are, you have to be kind of cool to be like, to be in the circles where you know local artists and buy that. So I don't think like the mainstream got a lot of sort of from that, but I think it's fine. And sometimes when we have capabilities, it's, again, we did that. Well, more of a mainstream thing is we did the Christmas charity campaign again this year, and we raised very close to 100,000 euros in Finland. And we're doing that in some other markets as well at the moment.
What was that about? Like, how did you raise the money?
So within the app, there was a restaurant where you could buy a meal for a family who doesn't have the means to buy a proper Christmas meal during Christmas. And so you could donate from 5 euros, I think, to 50 euros. And it would actually, and I think this was a good touch this year. So last year, I think we did that and it just said 5 euros. And you could choose how many 5 euros you wanted to give. But this year we had images of what that 5 euros gets you. And so it showed you get essentially like some pastries. Mm. That was 5 euros. And for a tenner you got like a bottle of Glühwein on top of it. And only for 20 euros did you start to actually get a meal. And 50 euros you got a proper meal, like for a small family. So like, last year, I think I just only gave 10 euros because I was like, yeah, I'm going to be generous and give 2 of these 5 euro things. This year, I see, oh my God, you don't get anything for 10 euros. Well, of course, you don't really. But that, when I saw what it gives, I had to go a bit higher this year. So we raised roughly 100,000 euros with that. And we pay the commission as well. So like that is just the whole amount goes directly to Hope, I think, okay. is the organization that actually handles the distribution and whatnot. So we are not, we don't have charity permissions and whatnot. So we are not, we can't raise it to ourselves. There's always a partner who is actually gets the money and does all the actual work. And we just borrow, like we give our service to be used for with that.
Thank you for listening to Nudging Pixels. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to leave a review on your podcast app. It really helps new listeners find us. You can also tell us what you thought about today's episode and give us any other episode suggestions on nudgingpixels@houston-inc.com. Once more, that's nudgingpixels@houston-inc.com. We are also on Twitter @nudgingpixels. We would love to get to know you, our listeners.
We release a new episode on the second Friday of every month. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Our theme track is by Niko Salminen. Visual design and art by Illusia Sarvas. This episode was recorded and edited at Houston Inc.'s office in not-so-sunny Helsinki.
That's perfect. That was perfect. That's good. Thank you.